It's Life and Taxes with Andrew Foster here on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And every week, of course, we enjoy a little bit of, well, information and recommendations from Andrew, of course, at Harvell and Collins, where his one of his areas of expertise is tax law and estate management. And with that, Andrew, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
So what is the issue this week?
Yeah, so Lockwood, attorneys must perform continuing legal education every year. Mm-hmm. The state bar requires us to get 12 hours of continuing education in order to keep our license to practice law. Mm-hmm. And so it's always interesting because our deadline for completing it is ironically in February. So just last month, you know, a lot of lawyers were scurrying around to try to get their hours in for the year. And I was one of them. And I had the opportunity to attend the Elder Law Annual Conference virtually, which is just great. The conference itself was in Greensboro, but through the means of technology, able to be at the conference through the computer. Mm-hmm. And it's always interesting when you have these conferences, especially the annual estate planning conference and the annual elder law conference, because the topics are always just, you know, right on point relative to the issues of the day. And one of the things they do at all of these conferences is give you an update on where things stand relative to new statutes, new cases that have come out from the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court and the federal courts relative to the topics at hand. In this case, elder law and estate planning.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, one of the cases caught my eye, as you can imagine. And I thought that it might be nice to go through and talk about the case. It's not one that applies to everyone, but I think the main thing I want our listeners to take away from it is that there's some pitfalls that you need to be aware of relative to, you know, challenging certain estate documents. And really, when it comes to paternity issues, the state of North Carolina has a very harsh standard. And so I wanted to get into that as well in case we have some listeners that are out there that might have these type of issues and make sure they want their, you know, children that were born out of wedlock to be able to take from their estate.
Uh-huh.
So that's really the issue that we have at hand in this case. So just for background's sake, just want to kind of set the stage, which is when you have a will, Lockwood,
mm-hmm.
That has been admitted to probate, the only way for an individual to challenge that will is through what's called a caveat proceeding. Okay. Mm-hmm. And a caveat proceeding is a challenge to the document itself. And really, there's three ways that you can challenge a will under North Carolina law. The first way is you claim that the document was not properly executed. So what that means is there's a problem with the four corners of that document. You know, did it meet the standard to be a valid last will and testament under North Carolina law? You know, for example, if it's a written attested will, you got to have two witnesses in order to make that document a valid, legal, written, attested will.
Mm-hmm.
The next way you would challenge it would be through capacity. You know, did the individual know their family? Did they know their assets? And then did they understand that the document that they're signing, you know, disposes of those assets at their death?
Right.
That's really the standard. It's a low bar. But, you know, you've got to be able to meet that capacity element in order to execute a will. And if you don't, that will could be subject to challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last way is through undue influence. So undue influence is where you say someone's will becomes your will,
right.
For lack of a better term, meaning that someone had such control over you that your wishes became their wishes.
Right.
And, you know, this is done through tons of evidence that you have to put on relative to, you know, was the person susceptible? Meaning, were they up there in age potentially? Did the person have some level of power over this individual?
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are things that you look at. Do they keep them isolated? I mean, there's just lots of factors that are involved with whether or not undue influence occurs. But that's the way that you challenge a will. So I want to preface our case talk by just by putting out the caveat elements there. So Lockwood, we got a case. It's in re will of Moore, and we have John Moore, who executed a will in late 2018, and he named his sister, Alfreda Matthews, as his executor and the beneficiary of his estate. So pretty simple here. We got John Moore, leaves a will, names his sister, she's the executor, and she's the sole beneficiary.
Right.
He died about a year later. And, of course, Alfreda Matthews goes and probates the will and does the proper proceeding to get that will admitted to probate. And lo and behold, John Moore's biological daughter, and I'm putting that in quotes, by the way, air quotes, as we talk, Diana McDougal, she filed a caveat proceeding. And she challenged the will on the basis of her being the sole biological daughter. And she said that the will was lacking proper witnessing and the will was procured by undue influence. So here we are. We've got daughter proposed purportedly against the decedent's sister. And yeah, exactly. So here we go. We're off and rolling, and she files this action. And the very first thing that happens is Alfreda Matthews challenges the ability for Diana McDougal to even bring this action, saying that she lacks standing. And you're probably scratching your head, Lockwood, and you're like, wait a minute here. Well, Andrew, you said, you know, Diana McDougal is the sole biological daughter. Of John Moore. Why would there be a problem with her challenging this will? Because clearly, if she's the biological daughter, she would be a taker under intestate law if this will were to be set aside. And the issue we have, Lockwood, and the reason I kept telling you I was putting in air quotes about her being the biological daughter, is that Diana McDougal was born out of wedlock.
Right.
So, therefore, she has to meet certain statutory requirements in order to be considered the biological daughter of John Moore and, therefore, a potential taker under intestate law.
Right.
And these are strict. Lockwood, and this is really one of the main reasons I wanted to bring this up to the listeners today, because these are very strict. You need to have, number one, an adjudication of paternity, meaning that a court of law has adjudicated you to be the parent of this particular child. You need a written acknowledgement by the father during his lifetime and the child's lifetime that is again, filed with the register of deeds. You know, you need to be on the birth certificate, or you need to have some document stating that you are the father.
Okay.
Or you need DNA evidence, again, secured within 1 year of the putative father's death, in order to be the, you know, the true quote unquote biological daughter of an individual. So you got three ways to do it: an adjudication of paternity, a written acknowledgement, or DNA evidence secured within 1 year. And Lockwood, if you can't meet one of those three standards, then I got news for you. Wow. You're not going to be successful as far as a challenge goes. And the issue in this particular case is Diana McDougal could not meet any of those standards.
Really?
And the court of appeals is one of those kind of situations where it's like, well, you may or may not be the biological daughter, and you may have good evidence to show that, you know, you were the, you know, he treated you like a daughter. He did this. He did that. Guess what? Not good enough. Strict standard. If you can't meet one of these three elements relative to being, that being your father, then the court has no mercy relative to you. And the Court of Appeals ultimately said that Diana McDougal lacked standing because lacked standing, and therefore the court had no subject matter jurisdiction over this matter to hear it, because she couldn't meet the strict standards of being able to prove that John Moore was in fact her father. So this is a case, Lockwood, you know, that I think two things that our listeners need to hear, which is, number one, if you find yourself in a situation where there's a child born out of wedlock, you need sure that if you want that individual to be included, you know, number one, you either need to get a will and include them in it, or number two, you need to take one of these three steps that I just went through, really number one or number two in this particular regard, you know, to make sure that you acknowledge paternity so that your child will be able to be an intestate taker under North Carolina law. The second thing is that standing is crucial in these type of matters. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have no standing, you have no right to be in court. You have no right to assert these claims. And the reason for it is very simple in this particular case, Lockwood, because if Diana McDougal cannot prove that she is a biological child of John Moore, then guess what? It does her no good to get the will set aside, because if the will is set aside, she's not an heir.
She's not an heir.
She's not a taker. So therefore, the court says you have no right to be here and to challenge this will, because you get nothing out of it at the end of the day. If even if you get this will set aside, guess what? You do not stand to benefit from this action. Therefore, you have no right to challenge this document. So it's very critical, you know, when we get into these cases, you know, to make sure that the facts are analyzed properly and that you have this right to even be in court to have your matter heard. And unfortunately for Ms. McDougal in this regard, you know, you kind of feel for her because she probably was the biological daughter of John Moore. But the fact is she could not prove it, and therefore she couldn't prove it. She had no standing, and the court had no subject matter jurisdiction to handle, to even entertain the matter.
We're talking with Andrew Foster of Harvell and Collins. And again, I want to remind you about this. You can always reach out to Andrew via phone at 252-726-9050. That's 726-9050. Or you can go online to their website, harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please. harvellandcollins.com. Andrew, you know, as we come close to wrapping this up, one of the things that you have said over and over again, and so do your compatriots there at Harvell and Collins, Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that is the devil's in the details. You've got to watch these details. But you know the other aspect of this, and we don't have time today, it is fascinating. The term is elder law and estate planning. And I want to talk about that at some point, about the whole concept of elder law. It's a whole concept here that's relatively new, I would say. But the other activity that I want to mention, and I can really appreciate the state's very strict requirements for proving, you know, a caveat or a challenge, especially in the case of an accusation or a claim of a relationship. I can appreciate that, you know, elderly people who might meet all the other caveats relative to capacity, but still be confused, could be led into a bad situation. I think that's important. And I say that really just sort of to say that the state has definite concerns here, does it not?
No doubt. Yeah, and I think that the situation is that a will in North Carolina has sanctity, Lockwood.
Right.
You know, it is, as you can see here, you know, the sister, Alfreda Matthews, takes that will to the probate court, and it is probated, you know, and it is the will. But you're right. There is a legal means to challenge that document. And if you know, you can meet these standards, and they're harsh standards, but if you can meet the lack of execution, the lack of capacity, or the fact that this document was procured by undue influence, and put on the evidence necessary, then, you know, you can get that will set aside.
Right.
So it's one of those things, you're right, Lockwood, which is we want that will to be, hold sanctity, because we want that to be a good document.
Right.
But then you understand the flip side, which is, unfortunately, you know, we deal with this on a weekly basis here at Harvell and Collins. We see that that unfortunately is individuals' age, the susceptibility
right.
for individuals to take advantage of them really increases, and so we're cognizant of that. And you know, we know that look, the devil is in the details, like you said, Lockwood, and it could be that when you start peeling back that onion, that there's more there, And, you know, it's important whether you want to make sure your will is going to be upheld or whether on the flip side you think that a will is procured by some type of undue influence or lack of capacity. You know, you need to assert those claims, and there's timing issues with that as well. So certainly here at Harbell and Collins, we see it in all shapes and sizes and want to make sure the planning is done properly on the front side or on the back side. If there's a reason to challenge, we get that timely file, make sure you have that standing, and, you know, we're able to put forth the evidence to potentially challenge an individual's procured improperly. So
that's, I think, an important issue. Life and Taxes with Andrew Foster, again, of Harvell and Collins. And that phone number, 252 area code, 726-9050. It pays to get good legal representation. Andrew, as always, thanks for your time.